Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of Rob Porter, the rising star in the White House, who was dating Hope Hicks, the young woman who spends more time with Donald Trump than any other aide. Although his history of spousal abuse was known, it was not acted upon until a picture of the first battered wife appeared, followed by testimony from the second, who claimed he called her an effing bitch on their honeymoon. Then a third woman, an ex-girlfriend working in the Trump administration, came forward recently and told the White House counsel Porter had abused her as well as his ex-wives. Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she has an article, Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared, joins us. We will discuss how Porter's boss, General Kelly, after defending Porter and praising him effusively, has not just been exposed as a hardline ideologue and hardly the adult in the room everyone was hoping for, but the military disciplinarian is showing signs he is not diminishing the chaos at the White House, but instead is adding to the incompetence. Then, after Nancy Pelosi's eight-hour-long defense of the Dreamers before the House yesterday, we will assess what strategies the House minority can employ against a majority of Republicans who are anti-immigrant and a White House that is stirring up xenophobic and nativist anger. We will speak with Margaret Hugh, a professor of law at Washington and Lee Law School. She served as special policy counsel in the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and we will discuss how Democrats can leverage the threat of a government shutdown to achieve their goals without repeating the mistakes of the recent government shutdown. Then finally, we will speak with one of the nation's leading experts on intelligence organizations, Locke Johnson, the author of a timely new book, Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. He was staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence and was at the forefront of the reforms that brought about the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees, and we will discuss how Trump's stooge, Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is single-handedly wrecking his committee and destroying the bipartisanship that is essential in protecting our national security. And joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the columns Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence. She also hosts the podcast Amicus, and her latest article at Slate is Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dahlia. And let's start with the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who was previously head of Homeland Security. When he was brought in to be Chief of Staff after Reince Priebus was fired, there was a sense that, oh, good, we got another adult in the room along with McMaster and Mattis, the generals. But it seems like he went under the radar a little as the kind of hardline ideologue that he really is. And more, he seems to be exhibiting signs not just of being a kind of nativist and totally in sync with Donald Trump, his boss, as opposed to trying to contain and restrain him, but he also seems like he may be also incompetent.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a really bad week. You know, I think it would have been bad enough if he hadn't implied that the Dreamers who didn't sign up under DACA were lazy. That was a misstep. And then instead of saying, I shouldn't have said that, he doubled down and you know, re-upped that was what he really meant. And then this situation with Rob Porter, where, again, I think he had ample opportunity to say, I didn't mean to, you know, impugn the integrity of the women who reported abuse. I didn't mean to say what I said. Instead, double down and double down again. And so I think there is a way. Maybe it's the siege mentality that when you feel that everybody is in a conspiracy to get you and to show weakness, to admit you made a mistake, is to empower the other side. I can't quite figure out why repeatedly this week, given the opportunity to fix errors, he has refused to do so. It must have at bottom something to do with not wanting to show weakness and not wanting to show weakness to a president who only prizes never backing down.
Well, both Chief of Staff General Kelly and Orrin Hatch, who Rob Porter used to work for, both came out of the gate with effusive praise for Rob Porter, as though he walked on water. And it seems like it was only when the photograph of the first ex-wife of Porter's with a black eye seems to have changed the narrative, to the point now, of course, where the White House spokesman Raj Shah said today that we could have done better. So that is, I guess, when you say they don't, you know, they're all in the following the Frank Sinatra playbook. They never apologize, right? But in this case, that was a kind of tacit or lame apology. So what is your sense then of whether or not they can weather this in terms of there's the Me Too movement that's out there. There's a, you know, one of Trump's closest friends, Steve Wynn, just lost his job, both at, as the finance chair of the RNC, but also as the head of his multi-billion-dollar corporation. So there's something happening out there, and it does seem like John Kelly and I assume by extension Donald Trump are out of step with it. Is it going to, I mean, he's so far Donald Trump, you have to admit, he's gotten away with paying off a porn star and having about 12 women attack him and accuse him of sexual harassment and going on video for the whole world to hear that he is a celebrity. And one of the great benefits of being a celebrity is you can grab women by the private parts and get away with it. So when's he going to be pulled over by the Me Too movement?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's this causation question, which is, would the Me Too movement have even begun but for Donald Trump? And I think, you know, in the most concrete way, you know, that Access Hollywood video you're referring to really was sort of the beginning of women starting to say, here's my story, here's my story. And then it reaches, you know, a real zenith around the Harvey Weinstein allegations. But I think that there is some reason to think that a lot of Me Too is women experiencing a deep and resonant sense that what they're watching happen with Donald Trump is something that triggers a memory, you know, sometimes a really, you know, embarrassing personal intimate memory, or sometimes something that women brushed away and said, oh, you know, this is just the world we live in. And I think that there is some reason to believe that the more Donald Trump chooses to be blind to that, the more you're going to have what we saw in Alabama with Roy Moore, where, you know, it turns out you can't, even as Donald Trump, endorse and support somebody, you know, who has multiple credible allegations of child sexual impropriety. There is a line at which voters will say, I don't feel that I want to go there. And I think that that was Alabama. And I think that that is Rob Porter. And so I do think that whether it's causal or not, the fact that the Trump view of the world continues to be never apologize, never admit, never surrender, just move on, I think is starting to lose whatever salience it has. I think certainly among women, I think it's fairly evident that women don't accept that you can continue to treat people like this or surround yourself with people who treat women like this and get a pass. But I think more pointedly, we're really starting to see women, and I think this is, for me, the under kind of semi-underside of the Rob Porter story, women who feel that, look, I complained. You know, I went to my church, I went to a counselor, I reported this to family, I told the FBI during a clearance, you know, check. I thought that once John Kelly knew about this, something was going to happen. And at every turn, the system failed to hold him accountable. And I think that what's really profoundly different now, and this I think transcends Me Too, is women starting to say, well, if the system cannot, the formal legal system, hold men to account, then I really do have to be activated. I'm going to have to figure something out. And I think that that's not just women, by the way. I think that's people across the boards. And so you are going to have some fraction, I think, of the population who still thinks that Donald Trump is a wizard and speaks truth to power, and that women are snowflakes and they should stay in their place. But I think of the 30-whatever percent of voters who were ambivalent or conflicted or confused or not engaged in this conversation when they voted for Donald Trump, I think every day that goes by that they don't reckon with that is a day that they lose voters. You cannot see what happened with Rob Porter, I think, and be ambivalent anymore.
And Dahlia Lithwick, in your article at Slate, Rob Porter's history of domestic abuse wasn't a secret. It's just that no one cared. You point out that he's very much a golden boy, a Rhodes Scholar, Harvard, son of a prominent academic. And I didn't know that he'd been dating Hope Hicks. Previously, she was dating Corey, what's his name, Lewandowski, right?
She's having quite a run. Yep.
Uh-huh. So this is the handsome guy that's in the White House. Are they still an item? I don't mean to sound too tabloidy here, but...
Well, the Daily Mail reported in their original reporting around Rob Porter, they were the first, I think, to break the story that they were dating. And so it's not too tabloidy because I think this was a story broken, by a pretty tabloidy enterprise. And the last I've seen is that, I don't know if they're still dating, nobody's made a public statement, but I do know that the statement that initially released supporting him was in part written by Hope Hicks. And that's just unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it tells you how strange a world we live in where, former accusers of domestic violence are coming forward to report against someone and his current girlfriend is helping message it. And it's, in a way it goes to how small and weird and incestuous the world of the White House is. But it also, I think, goes to this question of, who at the White House is the adult? I mean, if John Kelly is meant to be the adult in the room and his response is, I stand by him and he's an honorable man and I'm honored to serve with him, and only after really horrifying photographs emerge to distance himself, then if that's what the adults in the room are saying, who are the real adults? And I think that, I say this as the mother of children and just as a woman in this world, the idea that you would ask adults to support victims and have the adults instead denigrate them, mm-hmm. I think is just a really terrifying lesson for vulnerable people of any ilk.
Well, some people are terrified by the fact that Donald Trump spends most of the day with a 28-year-old former model as his number one advisor and closest confidant, which is in itself a little strange. But the hypocrisy is so glaring. They have gone to town on the FBI agent and his girlfriend and their correspondents to build this case of a secret society within the deep state. And they were basically a couple exchanging emails, and now you have a couple inside the White House. Let's get a hold of their texts and emails, can we?
Well, I think it's, I don't want to read their texts and emails, and I also don't want to condemn, couples.
People are entitled to have fall in love with whoever they. I'm not the love police here.
No, I know, but I think it was wrong of the Justice Department even to throw the FBI couple under the bus and to reveal all their texts. I think that was an incredibly strategic and actually an ethical error to sort of throw all that out to be hashed over. But I think to your point, Ian, the fact that very recently we had Republicans trashing Hillary Clinton for failing to fire somebody who was later accused of improper behavior and going after her for her friendship with Harvey Weinstein, and then saying, oh, this guy who's actually got security clearance in the Oval Office and who apparently was handling every document that the president saw and who couldn't get the highest levels of security clearance because we all knew he had a history of domestic violence, that's not a problem that we covered for him. I mean, that's the hypocrisy that kind of blows my mind.
Right, and the other person who can't get this high security clearance in the White House is Jared Kushner. But just in closing, it feels like you need two women in this world. If you go back to the hearings for the Supreme Court Justice Thomas, you recall Anita Hill was hung out to dry. There was a second witness who didn't show. It's some confusion about why that happened. Joe Biden did talk about it recently. But the long and the short of it is, is that what it takes? You got to have one woman with a black eye, and then that's the first wife, and then the second wife verifies everything and more, because it sounds like he was pretty dreadful to her as well.
Yeah, in my piece today, I quoted Catherine McKinnon, who's a iconic professor at Michigan. And she had an amazing piece in the New York Times last Sunday where she described, in the context of why the legal protections that are meant to exist for women continue to fail women. And she said, when she was looking at campus rape allegations, she said, quote, it typically took 3 to 4 women testifying that they had been violated by the same man in the same way to even begin to make a dent in his denial. And she goes on to say that made a woman, for credibility purposes, 1/4 of a person. And I think that that's exactly what you're saying. You know, you needed 4, 5, 6 people to come, to say that Clarence Thomas had done what Anita Hill was alleging, and you're quite right. Joe Biden did not call those other people who would have made one whole person. But I do think that is exactly the pattern we saw playing out with Rob Porter. We had both ex-wives who had told the FBI a long time ago and had told other people a long time ago, and then a third woman who came forward anonymously and talked to Don McGahn, White House counsel, about her experience with him, and that 3/4 of a person apparently didn't amount to enough that the White House took it seriously or that John Kelly felt that he could take those claims seriously. So I think we're still tragically in Anita Hill's world where unless there are more than 4 of you, you better find a posse because you're not going to be credited with telling the truth. And, that isn't an argument for witch hunts or for, believe everyone. It's an argument for why can't we think as systemically and respectfully of a woman's rights as we think of the accused rights. And we're just failing on that front dismally right now.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the columns Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence. She also hosts the podcast Amicus, and her latest article at Slate is Rob Porter's History of Domestic Abuse Wasn't a Secret, It's Just That No One Cared. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how Democrats can leverage the threat of a government shutdown to achieve their goals without repeating the mistakes of the recent government shutdown.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Margaret Hugh, who is a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law, who teaches immigration policy, national security, cyber surveillance, and civil rights. Previously, she served as senior policy advisor for the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and also served as special policy counsel in the Office of Special Counsel for Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices at the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Hugh.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of what's happening in the House? Yesterday, Wednesday, Nancy Pelosi held the floor in high heels for 8 hours. That's pretty extraordinary for the 77-year-old. And what was that all about? And today, it's some confusion about what the strategy is here. We don't know at any moment, Paul Ryan is saying that they can take a vote. Do the Republicans have enough votes? And what can Nancy Pelosi do? They obviously don't want to touch the Dreamer issue. She's trying to force them to do it. What can she do?
Well, I think that what is happening is a debate that goes beyond this particular budget, beyond a shutdown, beyond politics. I think it really goes to the American dream. And I think that that's part of what Nancy Pelosi was trying to convey in her record-breaking 8-hour speech. I think she was trying to explain the stories of the lives of these young people and why they see themselves as Americans, just Americans waiting for the right paperwork. But in every sense of the word, they see themselves as deserving access to the American dream. And I think Nancy Pelosi and many of these other politicians are trying to champion the right to that American dream.
But in terms of being a legislative strategist, she's rolling the dice for the Dreamers. We know that the House Republicans are a staunchly anti-immigrant party. That's what they've become. And we know the President of the United States is staunchly anti-immigrant. And just the other day, he taunted the Democrats by saying, "I'd love a shutdown," where he conflated the MS-13 street gang with Dreamers, which is pretty despicable in itself. So he's basically, you can see what his strategy is, go ahead and make my day, shut the government down for so-called illegal immigrants, while I'm appealing to me, Donald Trump, I'm appealing to the real Americans who you Democrats don't care about.
I do believe that that's part of the political rhetoric. It's appealing to a very nativist, a very xenophobic, unfortunate narrative, and it has a certain appeal for some. But I think that what Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin and many other politicians are trying to do is they're trying to refocus attention on what is a different strategy, a bigger tent strategy, and a strategy that looks, I think, towards the long game, knowing that that political rhetoric really has limited appeal. It doesn't have widespread appeal beyond a certain core base, and many Americans, the polling shows, are actually in favor of some type of protection for these Dreamers.
Well, obviously, there must be some, what they call in the military, an after-action report after the Democratic shutdown. That 3-day shutdown did not work for the Democrats, and they did have their Senate debate. They did have the budget bill, but there's no protection for the Dreamer. That their fate's left unresolved. And obviously, Nancy Pelosi has got a hostile anti-immigrant majority, at least it seems that way, that she's dealing with on the other side. So how does she use the leverage of the government running out of money in a matter of a couple of days and the debt ceiling also needing to be lifted in a couple of days? How does she do it? Because Chuck Schumer used the leverage and he didn't follow through. That's been the most of the kind of Monday morning quarterbacking. What do they get out of it? That's the big question. Well, now she's got a second chance. What can she do to maximize the leverage without the blowback?
I mean, that's a very good question, because there was a lot of criticism of the Democratic leadership through such a short shutdown and then with exactly what was the payoff for it. So that was one of the criticisms of the prior shutdown. But each opportunity here to take a stand, I think, can't be taken away. There's some type of, I think, benefit by throwing the issue on the table and explaining the issue of these Dreamers and what they bring to the American principles and, I think, ultimately to what we see as our constitutional values and our American values. So I think that even if there is not exactly a short-term payoff,
I think that there is a long-term payoff here, and using each shutdown as that opportunity to raise these issues. And beyond the Dreamers issues, you had like the child insurance plan raised. You had other issues raised as a result of forcing these issues and making sure that they're on the table and in the minds of the voters, and especially with 2018 being an election year. I think with the midterms coming up, there's a real need to show a very sharp distinction with the other party, and they're using the shutdown as the way to force that rhetoric.
Well, so far, the Senate bill has added $80 billion to the Pentagon this current fiscal year and another $85 billion next year. And to offset that, the non-defense spending would be increased by $63 billion this year and $68 billion next year. And that, of course, on top of the anti-immigrant passions, if you will, amongst Tea Party Republicans. They're also deficit hawks, except they weren't deficit hawks when they passed the recent tax bill that basically gave $1.5 trillion to the wealthiest Americans and the biggest corporations. So it seems like you would think that there'd be double jeopardy there, but Paul Ryan seems to think that he's going to get the vote and win the vote. So, and as I say, it could happen at any moment.
They do control the votes, and I think that that's important to keep in mind. When you have that majority in office, they're able to set the terms, and in a way, you can only have things like these threats of the shutdown, and you have this type of speech that Nancy Pelosi gave as the method to counteract the fact that they don't have the votes, that they're not in the majority, they don't have the power. And so I think that this is showing what happens as far as, you know, what the Democrats are trying to point out when they don't have the majority. And they are really hoping to use this 2018 election as a way to stage a comeback in the votes.
Well, it seems, though, on the other side, that there is a strategy on the part of Donald Trump and the Republicans to do the opposite, which is to encourage xenophobia and nativism and to use these dreamers as a pawn. He's already conflated the MS-13 gang as though criminals are only crossing the border, not these kids escaping from criminals in El Salvador, for example. So that's already been established. Trump, after all, created this dreamer crisis by rescinding President Obama's deferred action for childhood arrivals. And the House, and again, the House Republicans, after the Senate, with a supermajority in 2013, had passed a comprehensive immigration reform bill, the House absolutely stripped it and held it up. And you've got nativists like Steve King in the House saying the most outrageous stuff, and not to mention the Chief of Staff in the White House, John Kelly, the general everybody thought was going to be an adult in the room, insulting dreamers and saying they're lazy and they can't get off their asses and stuff like this. So is that, at the end of the day, what the Democrats are up against, a kind of ugly nativist, hateful strategy that may really be a referendum on the country, on whether or not our better angels are going to emerge?
Well, I wanted to raise one point about that comment by the White House Chief of Staff. A lot of the Dreamers felt that there were certain risks attached by coming out of the shadows, registering, giving your biometric data, giving the Department of Homeland Security that opportunity to do a background check, and then making themselves potentially more transparent to a future administration like we have now, that would not be in favor of the DACA program. And so to imply that there was some type of laziness involved in the failure to register, I thought was really not exactly accurate given how many risks were attached to coming out of the shadows. But I also wanted to address your issue, I think a really good one about this nativism. And I think that it's forcing this type of rhetoric, a reconciliation and a really deep look into our background in the United States. We have had a very troubled history with immigration, from the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s to the National Origins Act of the 1920s. And it wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s that we repealed the National Origins based formula through the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. So I think a lot of us forget that the immigration reform that abolished the racist, xenophobic, nativist policies that were embedded in our legal system for almost over a century, it really wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, it could be that this type of forcing of a government shutdown issue, or the type of speech that Nancy Pelosi gave recently, helps us to remember that these types of legal changes didn't happen easily. They happened with a lot of difficulty and a lot of political setbacks.
Well, Margaret Hugh, I thank you for joining us. We're all sort of on tenterhooks waiting for this vote, and I'm sure more than anything the 800,000 Dreamers are as well. But it is unfortunate, and as I say, at the end of the day, it does feel like a broader referendum on us as a nation in terms of whether or not we're compassionate or xenophobic and hateful. So, again, I thank you.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Margaret Hugh, who is a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. She teaches immigration policy, national security, cyber surveillance, and civil rights. Previously, she served as senior policy advisor for the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and also served as special policy counsel in the Office of the Special Counsel for Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices at the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with one of the nation's leading experts on intelligence organizations, Locke Johnson, about his timely new book, Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon, and his latest book just out is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Ian, it's always a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And Locke, you, for this book that you've written, you've interviewed every director of Central Intelligence between 1966 and 2004. You've also interviewed the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. From what I'm seeing, just watching interviews with former heads of CIA and NSA, et cetera, everybody is absolutely alarmed at the destruction of American intelligence. First, it was attacked by Donald Trump, but now it's being undermined, from what we can tell, by Devin Nunes, not just in releasing information to the public that the FBI and the DOJ adamantly did not want released to the public about the FISA courts, etc. But he's gone as far as to call his minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, and other Democrats on that committee a bunch of liars. And Trump has called them a bunch of liars and leakers. So I don't think you could have a worse situation. And wasn't the intelligence committees, both the House and Senate committees, when you worked on setting them up in the first place, weren't they sort of organized around a principle of bipartisanship?
Well, Ian, you're exactly right about that. And I am recalling in my mind 1976, when we created the Senate Intelligence Committee, and then a year later, the House Intelligence Committee. This is all based on the work of the Church Committee, which investigated the CIA and the other intelligence agencies for 16 months, and found that, by and large, they're vital to the nation. They do good work, and we owe our safety to them. But unfortunately, some members of those agencies have become overzealous and done things that were in violation of the law. So the idea was to set up these permanent committees who could keep an eye on these now 17 agencies day in and day out. And we also thought, and that was the view at the time, that the committees would operate in a bipartisan manner. After all, intelligence was a very sensitive matter, fragile operations, perishable operations, and this couldn't be politics as usual. And if you look at the early committees, the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees in their first couple of decades, they honored that notion of bipartisanship and keeping intelligence out of politics. But then things went off the trail, and I think the first sign of that was when the Reagan administration wanted to pursue covert action in Nicaragua. By covert action, I mean the CIA trying to disrupt another government, whereas the Democrats under Jimmy Carter felt that the leader of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, was perhaps not the ideal friend to have in that country, but was a fairly trustworthy and certainly someone we could work with, and no one we wanted to invade. So there was a real difference of view there, and that was the first divide, I think, between the Republicans and Democrats on intelligence. And then, just if I may say briefly, along came Newt Gingrich, a representative from the state of Georgia, and his theory was, if you trash the Democrats enough, maybe the public will vote the Republicans in a majority. And the theory seemed to work out pretty well. But unfortunately, it poisoned the waters in Washington, and now you've got this hostility between the two parties, as magnified as never before by, as you point out, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
But it's not just the politicians that are in this poisonous, partisan, tribal kind of condition. It's the Republican voters, according to the latest poll. 73% of Republican voters believe what Donald Trump is saying, and that this investigations going on to him are biased, and that the FBI and the DOJ are in effect a bunch of sort of closet liberals and Hillary lovers. I mean, it's an insane idea, but 73%, and that's been been the drumbeat of Fox News and other in the right-wing media have been creating this kind of narrative for some time, but apparently it has stuck. And the other statistic that just came out in a poll yesterday, that in 2015, 85% of Republicans had admired the FBI, and today it's down to 38%.
Yes. Well, Ian, I think what we see at work here is the White House propaganda machine getting the word out to the right-wing media, and the American people, understandably, hear all this news, and they wonder if it might not be correct. But I think in the fullness of time, over the next few months, particularly as the special counsel reports on his investigation, we're going to have a better, more balanced set of facts. And then the American people, as they always do, will make a more sound judgment once all the facts are in. So this is a preliminary and actually misguided view of the facts, I believe, based on what I know. But I think this is good to have this debate, and I can't wait for Mueller to have his report out. Unfortunately, though, if you look at the history of these two intelligence committees, which we started off talking about, never before, out of 15 leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee and 14 of the House, or I should say 12 of the House, have we had a leader so ideologically prone. He's got a perfect right-wing rating in the voting tabulations that various interest groups keep, and that's never been the case before. In fact, the average rating for leaders of those two committees has been right about 48, which is where you'd want it to be, I think, sort of an indication of moderateness between 100 and a zero. So we've gone from having moderate leaders to having this right-wing ideologue, and worse than that, he is nothing but a cheerleader for the White House. And he goes down, talks to the president periodically and finds out what he's supposed to do next and goes up on the Hill and carries out that agenda. So I must say, I say this with a heavy heart because I don't like to disparage any representative of the American people, but surely the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee must realize that their leader right now is ruining the House Intelligence Committee, and they have to find a replacement for him.
And you, of course, are referring to Devin Nunes.
Yes, Devin Nunes.
And again, I'm speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He is the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon. And his latest book just out is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. So my understanding, though, Locke, is that not just the poisoning of, as you mentioned, Devin Nunes is an ideologue, and the whole purpose of the, not the purpose, but the tradition of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees was to have bipartisan leadership and to sort of, you know, leave your partisanship at the door when you go into,
yes,
into the kind of, you know, the secret room where they talk about this stuff. So beyond the fact that he's made the House Intelligence Committee dysfunctional, my understanding is that foreign intelligence agencies and services that work closely with the United States are now having second thoughts, if not already closing the door on sharing information. We learned recently that Dutch intelligence was responsible for finding out that the Russian GRU was hacking the DNC, and that was real-time information, which obviously was very useful to,
yeah,
U.S. intelligence. There are many examples, and, you know, the Baltic Intelligence Service is apparently learning a lot about what Russia is up to. But why would these intelligence services want to share it now with the United States if there's a guy, you know, that's going to have oversight that can rummage through and their secrets and leak them according to his political dogma?
Yes, I think you make a good point. And as you recall, the FBI said to Nunes, look, don't declassify and release this document because it would lead to grave concerns for the country's national security. And yet he had not only had the Republicans support declassification on his committee, but then took it to the president, which is part of the rule, and the president was very happy to declassify it. So when you willy-nilly throw classified information into the air like that, it causes concern with our allies overseas. I think that can be overstated, though, because after all, these liaisons that we have with the Dutch and the British and many other people are so important to both of us, we're not about to abandon them. But still, it does cast a chilling effect, I think, on the relationship and may give pause to some of our allies before they share information fully with us. So, you know, there are rules in place to make sure declassified information is done in a very careful, slow, methodical way. And in Nunes' case, he didn't even have hearings on it. He could have brought up the FBI and he could have said, well, tell us what your grave concerns are. We want to hear more about this. But he didn't even bother. He just went ahead.
Well, but there's obviously complicity with the White House because General Kelly just said a couple of days ago that when asked about the fate of the Democratic rebuttal memo, which is now at the White House going through the same process, in the case of the Nunes memo, the White House didn't redact anything. And in fact, they absolutely overruled the pleadings from the FBI and the DOJ, who, for example, didn't want the names of all of the people that had authorized these FISA warrants. And of course, if you go through the list, they're all people that either Trump has forced out or has fired, and with the last one being Rosenstein, who seems to be in the crosshairs at the moment. But the double standard is so flagrant because now General Kelly's saying, well, you know, it's going to take us time. We're going to have to redact a lot of this Democratic memo, and we'll only release it if the FBI head Chris Wray and Rod Rosenstein approve it. Well, they didn't approve the last one, and the Nunes one, and they went ahead and put it out,
yes,
and defied them. But now they're saying, oh, we're going to play by the rules this time. And
yes,
so
right.
I'm not sure that the Democratic memo is ever going to see the light of day. And if it does, it'll be so shredded with redactions, it'll probably be completely incoherent.
it'll look like Swiss cheese. No, I think you're right. There's a double standard work here, and I think even Trump's base will wonder about the fairness of all this. After all, they're intelligent people, and they voted for him because they were concerned about their jobs and the sagging U.S. economy, at least in their part of the United States. So they had their reasons for voting for him, but I think that they've been disappointed by such things as this double-standard approach and his really cavalier approach to intelligence. You probably remember, Ian, when President went out to the CIA at Langley, Virginia, to speak to them early in his administration, he was outright insulting to them. He left there with not a friend, I don't think, because he had said so many disparaging things about intelligence being useless and biased and so on, which is really not the case, of course, but that's what, the way he viewed it. And now he's attacking the FBI. So these are extremely important, patriotic, hardworking, and usually quite reliable organizations. Obviously, they've gone off track, and my book talks about some of the times where they've broken the law because they became overzealous about some matters. But those were exceptional cases. For the most part, these reliable agencies was honest, patriotic, hardworking people, and we need them. And we need to have their morale high so they'll do good work. And the president and Nunes are just destroying that morale.
Well, in terms of the inside the Fox News bubble and the way that it's being framed by Trump is that this is essentially, and this is what the build-up to the Nunes memo was, they were basically beating the drum on the idea that there was a secret society inside the FBI based upon, you know, email exchanges or text message exchanges between a couple of FBI agents. That, so in effect, they were saying, you know, there's a secret society within the deep state. And this idea has taken on amongst Trump's supporters that this deep state is out to do in this president and is behind this bogus Russian inquiry.
Right.
That's their mindset. But the interesting thing that I'm hearing is I've talked to a bunch of retired intelligence officers, members, if you will, of the deep state.
Right.
And they're concerned about something quite different. They're concerned about a White House coup against American democracy. So
yes.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's depressing, actually.
Well,
Trump's people think that the deep state's out to get him. And people in the deep state are worried that Trump is out to undermine American democracy.
Well, I really do think we all need to keep our paranoia in check because one can get carried away here. Remember when Orson Welles gave the radio broadcast about how the Martians had landed in New Jersey and some people believed it and they took off to the hills? So we don't want to get too carried away here, but I think it is true, I believe, based on 40 years of studying the subject, there's no such thing as a secret society or a cabal within these agencies. These are a cross-section of American people. It used to be the CIA was known to be dominated by the Ivy League, but that was in the 40s and 50s. These agencies, CIA, FBI, and the other, I guess, 15 or 16 of them, are really a reflection of American society. And they're not that much different from the rest of us. So I think it's foolish to talk about the deep state. Now, remember Eisenhower's farewell address where he warned about a military-industrial complex. I think that's alive and well. And if you want to call that a deep state, I suppose you could, but it's not that secret. It's true that munitions manufacturers and people on the Armed Services Committees and some others, some generals, for example, or admirals, the Pentagon, have a vested interest in working on military projects, which goes beyond the tenure of any president who's there for 4 or 8 years. So, as Eisenhower told us, there is, in that sense, a kind of sub-government that's underway, but it's not at all the sinister kind of demon that some people have envisioned.
Well, the military-industrial complex just got a windfall in this budget agreement coming out of the Senate.
That's for sure.
Extra $80 billion on top of the...
Yes. Well, Ian, I'd love for you to explain to me why we have 10 going on 12 aircraft carriers, and the few other countries in the world that even have an aircraft carrier have one.
Right. And the Russian the Russian one is antique, and the Chinese one was bought from the Ukrainians.
I know.
And it's not particularly effective.
I know.
So, no, it's an extraordinary thing. But, Locke Johnson, just to go back to the history, because, you know, all the work that you did, and I must say, you know, I knew William Colby quite well, and he really did testify relentlessly before the Church and Pike committees, just opening up all of the abuses, and an extraordinary time it was, where all of the dirty laundry was aired. And the whole point was to make these corrective measures, which led to these oversight committees in the Senate and the House. And now we're in a situation where they're being undone by, you know, poisoned by partisanship. So what was the sense back then? Because it's sort of, you know, I mean, still to this day, some of the extraordinary. I mean, I remember talking to Bill Colby about James Jesus Angleton. How this one guy almost wrecked the CIA. So it's possible to have, we talked about Nunez being an ideologue and the wrong person to be anywhere near an intelligence committee. But, I mean, I don't know about Pompeo. I don't know what these characters are like now. But you go back to people like Angleton, you think, my God, you know, it's lucky we survived.
You know. Well, no, I think you make some wonderful points, but we do have to be careful about describing an organization based on some rather bizarre individuals. And I think Angleton, I've got a whole chapter in my book on Angleton, was kind of an outlier and a strange individual in a lot of ways. But I think he's not the typical CIA officer by any means. Again, let me repeat, a typical CIA officer is someone I think the American people would respect, well-educated, well-meaning, patriotic, hardworking. And the same would be true with people in the other intelligence agencies, which is not to say, as you pointed out, that occasionally they haven't strayed off the reservation and done things that they shouldn't have. And that's why we created those two intelligence committees, one in the Senate and one in the House. And we were very respectful of Bill Colby because he was willing to understand that we needed to have intelligence within the framework of the Constitution, not lying outside the Constitution. So, in fact, he used to say CIA, Constitutional Intelligence in America. And that's what our common goal was. Of course, he took a lot of flack from President Ford and Henry Kissinger for being too open. But Colby's view was, and he was right about this, if he wasn't forthcoming and cooperative with Congress, we would have shut down the CIA. So he came forward within limits. He wasn't completely candid about everything. He didn't want hearings on covert action, for example, and we honored that. But he came forward and helped us understand Operation Chaos, the spying on American citizens, and other programs that were clearly way beyond the legal boundaries. And he helped us fix that problem.
Well, but as you probably know, Locke Johnson, many Americans on the political left and on the right, too, are very suspicious. On the right, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories, as we've talked about, the deep state. But on the left, there's a tremendous sense of the CIA being behind all of America's problems and have done terrible things in our name, if you will, around the world. And they have their finger in all kinds of coups. And we know that during the Cold War, the reason it was a Cold War was that neither side could afford to have a hot war. That would have ended the planet. So what they did was they kind of caused all this misery in the Third World via surrogate wars. And you could even argue that Korea and Vietnam were surrogate wars on a massive scale, but there were all kinds of small wars. So there's a legacy there of tremendous distrust. And I get mail, even by interviewing former CIA officers who I talk to, simply because I know they know a lot what I don't know. You know, they have the secrets. So, you know, you always, as a journalist, you're always trying to find out what the hell's going on.
I get called
a CIA agent or a
stooge. Well,
how do you address those people, in other words?
Well, I think you make some great points. And I remember a New Yorker cartoon some years ago where natives on a Pacific island were running away from a volcano as the volcano's lava was pouring out, and one native yelled to the other, "The CIA did it, the CIA did it." So the CIA is suspected of doing a lot of bad things around the world, and sometimes that suspicion is right. I mean, personally, I'm utterly appalled by the torture program they had. I mean, anyone who studied the literature on torture practices in the past realize it doesn't work, and it's such a blemish on the reputation of the United States. Or rendition, kidnapping people off the streets of Stockholm or other places who are suspected terrorists and flying them to Egypt so their intelligence service can do more brutal things against them than the CIA is allowed to do. I mean, all that waterboarding 137 times in one case, all that is just nauseating, because the great strength of the United States is our reputation for goodwill and fair play around the world, which is by and large accurate. But when we engage as a government in torture and rendition and metadata collection and getting wiretaps without warrants, that really plays into the hands of our enemies because it makes us look just like Russia, which we're not most of the time. But occasionally we've slipped because some people have been overzealous. And that's why we need these committees to be strong, neutral, bipartisan, constantly looking into these agencies to make sure they stay within the boundaries of the law.
Well, just in closing, Locke Johnson, what I find puzzling, though, in terms of what we're talking about, that is that the CIA basically gets blamed for essentially what the executive branch does, and we're talking basically about the president, in the sense that from what my studies, and I think to some extent they're reinforced in your book, Spywatching, presidents, when they come in, find, even like Jimmy Carter, they find that the CIA is the most interesting toy of the executive
right.
branch. You know,
you're right.
And I'm sure Donald Trump feels that way, too. And it's the presidents who task the CIA to do a lot of stuff that ends up getting them in trouble. But why do we let the presidents off the hook and blame the CIA?
Well, I think because over the years the CIA has gotten its reputation for overthrowing governments and even engaging in assassination plots and all the rest, and the literature and the reporting on it tends to say the CIA did this and the CIA did that. But I think you're right. In probably 90% of the cases, the CIA was following instructions from the White House. And since 1975 with the Church Committee, we now have pretty good reporting on some of these activities. For instance, the CIA cannot conduct a covert action, be it propaganda, economic or political disruption, or even paramilitary activities, without first getting a formal authority from the president, which didn't always happen in the past, and then, most important of all, telling the Senate and House Intelligence Committees about it in advance, so they'll have a chance to say, wait a minute, that's a stupid idea, don't do that. So I think we've gotten better in that domain, and the number of madcap operations overseas is I think, declined. But here at home and in Guantanamo and a few black sites and prisons abroad, the CIA got involved in yet more mischief with torture and rendition. So, you know, Thomas Jefferson used to talk about how eternal vigilance was the price of liberty, and that's so true today. And who's doing the vigilance for us? It's supposed to be the House and Senate Intelligence Committee. But in the House, you've got Nunes, who is not objective and not impartial and not representing the views of the Congress, but rather in the pocket of the White House. That's not acceptable.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and I thank you in particular for your new book, Spywatching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States.
What a privilege to be with you, and thank you very much for your kind words about the book, and I wish you all the best.
And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He is the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon. His latest book just out is Spywatching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was